Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show.
Okay, and now we're live.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, and anyone watching now or later. It's my absolute pleasure to be joined by Joshua Bilmes, the chairman of the Jabberwocky Literary Agency. Mr. Bilmes, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
So my first question to you, if you will allow me, is how does one become a literary agent? Is that something that you fall into, something you become, or something you have a plan for?
I mean, there are probably like an infinite number of career paths to becoming an agent. You know, I certainly didn't set out to be an agent. It's just when I was looking for publishing jobs, like 40 years ago, the first offer that came in was from a literary agency. So there I am. But that was about, as I said, knowing I wanted to be in publishing, but not, you know, but could have taken a lot of different paths than the one it ended up with. And I think a lot of people, they don't know a lot about publishing until they're actually in the business. Like maybe you know what an editor is, maybe you've seen some movie where book editors are, you know, on the screen, whether it's Misery or American Fiction or the werewolf thing with Jack Nicholson, like a gazillion. And by the way, the best movie about being an agent, 100% Vampire's Kiss with Nicolas Cage, most accurate depiction other than the vampire stuff. So there isn't a single way, and one of the kind of problems in a way with being an agent as a profession is literally anybody can do it. You can just, you know, anybody who's watching this can, you know, say the moment they're done, I'm going to become a agent and set up a website or whatever. There's no real, like, licensing, there's no testing, so it's not like a hard profession to break into, but like a lot of professions, it isn't an easy one to do well.
Okay, so in past conversations I've had in the channel with David Butler, who is the editor at Buy and Books, I said to him, oh, you know, literary agents, they are the sort of the gatekeepers of whatever genre is it, like in my case, mostly fantasy. And I said a sort of derogatory or pejoratively, and it was like, no, they are. That's exactly what they are. So why is that the need for the figure of the literary agent? Why can't aspiring authors contact the publishers directly?
I mean, sometimes they can't. You can meet an editor at a convention or writer's conference. There are occasionally open calls at publishing houses. But it comes down to money, really. It costs money to have people to look at submissions, the vast majority of which are going to be turned down. You know, we take on as clients fewer than 1% of the submissions that come in to the agency. And it's a decent chunk of like of the time for my assistant when I was just starting the agency. You know, in the 1990s, like I didn't have a big, you know, client list relative to what I did now. And I, but even so, some of the first things that I outsourced were I got people in to do the first screening of the query letters for me. And there was a really good slush reader who had like worked at Bain, worked at other places, whom I hired to do the first screening of partials. Like those are the first part-time employees that I ever had, because it just takes time and it takes money. And so the publishers have managed to put a good chunk of that on to us agents. So we become the gatekeepers. But I want to emphasize, though, that it doesn't have to go through us. Any author who is looking for an agent can be finding some publishers to approach, can be finding avenues to also be looking for a publisher, and should be trying for both, not just talking to, let me talk only to publishers and let me talk only to agents. It should always be that you're trying any path you can to get published.
Understood. So then what's the benefit of the value added of having found an agent?
Well, so I'll hold up a book, the paperback of Wake of War. Publishers don't do mass markets anymore.
Right.
But I was like, so the book's going to have really heavy appeal to military personnel. The pockets and the uniforms are only so big. The retail environment at a PX and a military base. I was like, please consider doing a mass market of this book. I don't know that the author would have had, you know, the idea themselves. And in part because the idea is coming from me, give all credit to the people at Tor that they were open to the idea of doing a mass market that'll be out in a couple weeks from when we're talking, when publishers are not doing them anymore. I've also been in the business 40 years. I've made mistakes. I remember all of them, kind of. So I'm not likely to make those same mistakes a second or fifth time relative to how likely the author would be to make a mistake once.
So on that note, sorry, would it be unkind to ask you what was your biggest mistake if you want to share?
I mean, like one that I've always remembered is I was selling a second book in a series and inadvertently let slip in language that arguably let them account that advance with the advance for the first book, which wasn't really what any of us, I think, had intended or talked about. But that was definitely a mistake. On a film deal, you'll be asked to agree that there are certain conditions precedent, as they're called, meaning the things that need to take place before the publisher considers the option clock to start. And I once did a deal because there was a major director and a major producer and everything attached, where one of the conditions precedent was, and we'll have signed our agreements with the director and the producer. Like, never do that. You don't have control over that. And then the studio tries to say that the option has never actually started because we never signed those pieces of paper. And honestly, we're not in any really big rush. Let's say you don't make that mistake twice.
Yeah.
It's a lot of arguing with people about that. You don't get to keep the clock from starting forever.
Okay. And, when I was also talking to David at Bayern, he said that sometimes, even though the author and the publisher may have arrived at a deal, sometimes things fall apart. The editor and the writer get at loggerheads, they cannot agree on things fall apart. Has that ever happened to you, or if that how does that place you? How does that leave you?
It's happened very rarely. I don't want to say never, but the agency has done hundreds, thousands of deals. Like, we're up to deal 5,000 in their database. And the number of times we've had a handshake and then the deal hasn't actually happened, 5 of those times, 10 of those times. So yes, it's happened.
So, but, yeah, no, it's rare. I appreciate that. So apart from sort of linking the publisher with the writer, what else does the job entail? Is there a level of coaching the author how to navigate that world as well?
It depends a lot on the author and the agent. I am very editorially hands-on, but there are times when I've had to dial back because the author is, I have the editor I've worked with for 20 books. They buy everything I write, So agent, editor, edit. And some authors may really want the kind of long-term career counseling. Mm-hmm. Others might just be I'm a celebrity and I'm writing a memoir and I want to sell my one memoir for a ton of money. Can we just go and do that? So it's always a question, and it's one of the things that, sorts out in the early period of an agent-author relationship is, what is the agent good at providing and what is the author looking to get?
Okay. And I'm assuming also in today's climate, things have changed a lot from, since the internet from 20 years ago. So a want to be traditionally published author these days, does it help if they have built up or have some sort of social media presence? They got some sort of already following before approaching you, or do you discard that?
I've been on panels and things with agents who've said one of the first things they do is go look at the social media. Okay. And then I'm whatever, I want to find a book that I really like, and that's the one thing that counts. Anything you have to offer that is better than what someone else has to offer can be a plus for you. But mm-hmm. there are plenty of novels that are sold by people who are not celebrities, who don't have social media, whom all they've done is gone and written a really good book. And similarly, anytime, you know, you're missing something that other people might have, it might make things harder. But a lot of this, any book that gets sold, it's the 97th percentile, it's the 98th percentile of all of the books that are out there waiting to sell to somebody. So a lot of the things that people talk about is affecting the ability for that to happen are real, and they make a difference sometimes to some people. But the biggest part of it is, if you're not at least in the 95th percentile or whatever, just of people looking to get published, none of the other stuff is really going to matter. And if you're actually up there in the 98th and 99th percentile of trying to do what, you know, something a lot of people are trying for, your odds of succeeding at it are actually pretty good. So that's not a perspective a lot of people like to take. And I don't say it entirely to diminish that there are obstacles or things you can do that make it easier. But the starting point is really be good at it.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that hope that eventually quality will come to the surface, isn't it?
Yeah.
And another question then. As a from the agent's perspective, someone approaches you with a book, someone approaches you with a fully developed, fleshed out series. They've already got maybe 3, 4, 5 books in the world they've created. Obviously, we're talking quality here, but do you find more appealing someone that comes to you already with a body of work where you can see continuity going forward, or would you just judge it on that first book?
I'm looking at the book that's in front of me. Part of that is just that you never actually know what the future is going to bring. I can take on somebody who's written 5 or 8 books in their series, but if the first book doesn't do well, it isn't going to really help that their trunk is more full of books in the series than somebody else's. And I can take on a book that I love and not be able to predict or know, even the author won't know, that they have written the only story they have to tell. There's a really erotic vampire novel, which isn't available anymore, called The Kiss, published under the name Catherine Rains. Like, if you can find a used copy, I think it's a really good book. I had no way of knowing that every book after that, the author would struggle. You'd ask them, can you make it better? And they'd make it worse. And I had no way of knowing that the author would die at a young age, and that his spouse would just kind of, like, you know, there, we fell out of touch. We're never going to get back in touch. You know, and this one book, if somebody came tomorrow to, I don't know what I would do with it. So I have to live in the day mm-hmm. and look at the book that's in front of me and ask, can I sell this book that's in front of me? But the part I'll add, though, is never query me and have a query letter that tells me only about your book. Because I embark on every relationship kind of hoping that I'm going to be working with that author for a long period of time and selling lots of books, and we're going to prosper and succeed together. And if you send me a query where you're acting like there's not a single interesting thing you would want to say about yourself, that isn't exactly positioning it as, you know, here's something that we're going to have a relationship and do great things. So, and then people will say, but there's nothing about me. And I'll tell them, tell me where you went to school and where you grew up. Maybe the person who reads the query letter went to the same school you did or grew up in the next town over, and you've just broken like the tie on whether the person will look at your manuscript. Always say something about yourself.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you, Alex. Like I said, some of the people that follow my channel is a aspiring author, and you just answered the question that he was going to present in the chat. So thank you. We've got something else here. Hello. Questions are allowed, of course. Are you seeing it harder to sell books that aren't necessarily following current trends in a post-COVID world? I don't know if necessarily post-COVID is a thing, but yeah.
I'll get back to what I said. I'm always looking for a good book. Romantasy is really hot right now, okay. But like, I'm not like the target audience for that. Cozy fantasy is really hot right now, but I can't only be looking for those things. Come at me with a good book. But there are some things, like a Western is going to be harder to sell outside of the, you know, shelves of the book section at Walmart, where there are a lot of them. You don't see Westerns like readily, like in a pharmacy, and it's like one shelf at a big Barnes & Noble. But hey, if Westerns are the thing you want to write one and do a really good job of it.
This is a nice segue into something I wanted to ask you. You've obviously have got vast experience in publishing fantasy. Tim Akers has been a guest of the channel. Obviously, you're known for being Brandon Sanderson's agent. I've got the theory, I'm starting to get the impression that everything has been done in fantasy. Is that, am I very wrong, or am I getting close to the reality?
Yes and no. There are certain things in the fantasy that I pick up and I read the opening lines page about, you know, the heir being spirited away from the castle that is under attack. I have in fact seen that plenty of times. But even there, I think there are versions of that opening page that I would find a lot more interesting and compelling to read than other versions of that exact same opening. The last fantasy novel with that opening has not been published. And the last to get across the finish line with that opening will not even be in my lifetime. But yes, there are things that somebody who reads a lot in a genre has seen a lot of times. The good news is there are always new readers coming along, always. And to them, something that to me feels been there, done that, can seem fresh and new. And that will always be an advantage for an author, that the reading pool refreshes itself.
Right. So that's very interesting. You say, obviously, we have new readers coming, but as a parent and as a teacher, I'm a high school teacher, I got the feeling, I get the perception that kids, children these days, read a lot less, that computer games, other forms of entertainment have taken over books, which are sort of a thing of the past. Have you experienced or noticed decreasing sales, or are books selling as much as they used to? And
people are still buying plenty of books. For some reason, there are certain trades, lines of work, with this discussion seems to come a lot more frequently than with others. Many people in the world have never seen a golf course or held a golf club or even like know somebody who has. But golfing is rarely talked about with the same gloom and doom as the basic fact that only a certain percentage of the population reads. Mm-hmm. Stipulated. 100% agree. Only a certain percentage of the population reads. Just like only a certain percentage of the population crochets, bakes muffins, you know, plays tennis, anything, there's only a certain percentage. And yet there are businesses that revolve around these things that last for decades and centuries without all of the kind of you know, constant hand-wringing that accompanies the fact that we sell books to only the people who read.
That's very interesting. Thank you. A couple of more questions that I got quickly, maybe. I, in the sort of circles I move, people have talked about, but particularly with fantasy, is it harder for a female author to break into fantasy, or is there some sort of gender bias there? Or, like, say, romance is a purely female-dominated market.
No, if there had been. And I would say that perhaps at one time there had, I feel like after Terry Goodkind, a lot of people entered the fantasy market that were doing like the Terry Goodkind thing, and that leaned heavily male. But like in fantasy today, you've got at least, you know, I don't have stats in front of me, but just it seems to me like you've got a lot of people breaking into the genre, both male and female. Mm-hmm. And you have a category like romantasy, which is the hottest thing right now, that is largely skewed female. But again, like maybe there are stats I need to be aware of that I just, you know, don't have access to, and I'm giving a different answer than I might have done 20 years ago.
Okay, I understand. And then, would you consider, in this day and age, I'm in Spain, would I be able to send you, not that I have any, but could I be able to send you like a draft of my book or whatever? Are you open to queries from all over the world, or are you limited to geographically the US?
All over the world. I mean, Simon Green is British and is one of my earliest clients, you know, that I've been working with since the 1980s, just to give an example of that. Email has also made that a lot easier. You don't need an airmail postage stamp to send me a query, and you don't need to attach an international reply coupon, which most people probably don't even know what it is. But once upon a time, you couldn't send an SASE really, because it's airmail and this and that. You would go to the post office and buy a little slip of paper that I would take to the post office and exchange to get an airmail stamp to respond to your hard copy query. Now you just go to Query Tracker and you query me, most everyone at this agency, or, you know, electronically. Okay. So.
And what about, again, someone like me for whom English is not the first language? Does that, even though I would like to think I can defend myself in English, or my English is good enough. If you saw someone with a clearly foreign name, is that counting against them because you think English is not the first language, the quality of the written English
isn't going to be that good? No, I've got to look at the book. There are some obstacles to selling translated literature in the U.S. that you usually need to get a sample of the work translated. And who's going to pay for that, and who's going to check the quality of it. But even there, sometimes there are authors who are perfectly fluent in, you know, for writing purposes, that they can write in English, write in their native language. So that isn't really a factor when we're looking at a query. It's what do we think of the manuscript? You know, what do we think of the query? And if we're looking at like an attached sample, if we're requesting from somebody, what do we think of the material?
No, thank you. Really, really appreciate that. And I'm mindful you gave me a time constraint earlier, and we've gone past that.
Yeah, so we can do another 5 minutes.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great. Right, if anyone in the chat has got any questions, please write them up. In the meantime, you've got, like I mentioned earlier, Tim Akers, which is the first traditionally published author I interviewed in the channel, Brandon Sanderson, both same agent, both the same number of books published, both different levels of success. What's the reality of once you become a published author? Is that it? Can't you just be a writer and forget about the day job? Or is that an ongoing process that will take a long time to get there?
And that just varies so much writer to writer. You can get a big first contract and just feel, you know, let me make the plunge. You can be like just at a level that you need to keep the day job for a long, long time. It's extreme variability and nothing lasts forever. People are talking about Stephen King and the 50th anniversary of Carrie, but I bet if I went to the New York Times machine to go to the bestseller list for the year that Carrie was published, there would be a ton of books by authors that none of us even knew existed. So you've always kind of got to be working to keep at the top of your game. I think that applies to me and it applies to every author that I work with. One thing I'll tell people a lot, think of a writing career as a highway. If you build an exit ramp, people will get off. Some of the cars in the highway will get off at every exit ramp you build.
Right.
Every book you write that doesn't kind of, you know, match your highest standard is an exit ramp. So you can hop on the highway and you can make choices where you're building a lot of exit ramps and make choices where you don't build very many. And those are going to be very impactful over your career, sometimes not immediately evident. The after effect of writing a bad book will be not when you write it, not even when the book is published, but possibly when the book after that is published, that you finally begin to see that a lot of people went off the exit ramp and didn't come back on. And I know from experience, like that's one of the things people won't believe until they've seen it. They'll think, you know, so people won't buy the book. You know, I know it's not my best, but then they'll come back.
Okay. last two questions from the chat, if you would answer them, please.
Yeah.
And then we'll call you out there. Thank you. So Joao Silva says, what's the standard advance for a fantasy debut these days? If you can, I suppose it varies, no?
Yeah, it does vary, but I'll talk to that a little bit, though. I'm just going to quickly check something online. Really low advance when I started, you know, sold my first book, 1986, was $3,500, which is equivalent to around $10,000 today. Mm-hmm. I'm still selling some books to smaller publishers for $3,500, and including ebook and audio formats that didn't even exist. Wow. So at a big publisher, though, where you basically, you can't publish a book that will only justify a $3,500 advance. You can only publish a book that the bean counters think will make money.
Right.
For them to buy a book for any much less than $15,000 or $20,000, they can't. So if they're not offering you at least like $15,000 or $20,000, there's probably more to be like pried loose out of them. And then maybe, are you talking about world rights in all languages or English language all over the world, or just in the US and Canada? But that kind of will help frame the discussion, that we're not going to do a lot of books with big publishers for less than that. There are plenty of publishers that are not big. And obviously, if a publisher is excited, or they're competing, or this or that, the money begins to go up from there.
Right. And we have one more question from Alex here. Would it improve the chances of a manuscript if it got professionally edited before submission? Is it worth the author spending the money on that?
A lot of times, maybe not, because as a beginning writer, you're ultimately dependent on your level of craft, and an editor can't necessarily change that. So, but I wouldn't want to say never either, because I know a lot of good people who are doing freelance editing. Editors that I sold a lot of books to and loved working with, and now they're doing freelance editing, and I know that they're really good at their jobs. But for the debut author, you just can't rely on that to take a book that is at the 50th percentile and make it into what I was talking about before, a book that is at the 98th percentile. Maybe if you're in the 80s or 90s, you can get professional help and it'll bring it up that extra step. But a lot of people, the underlying issue is not solved.
I could ask you 100 more questions. I'm sure the people in the chat could ask you 100 more questions. I am aware we've gone over your time limit. Thank you so much, and I wish we could carry on talking for another 45 minutes, but I really appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you. You know, unfortunately, I do have clients who've got it. But yeah. And I want to emphasize, you know, it seems like a challenge. It is, because you've got to be good. There's a lot of competition. Tastes vary. Even within my office, you know, we've got five or six people with very different tastes and profiles and what they read. But the really good stuff, I think, by and large, finds its way into the marketplace. And, you know, those of you, this is a dream you're aiming to pursue, you know, keep at it. I'm glad you're here, and always be learning. And thank you for giving people the opportunity to, you know, chat with and hear from your guests and learn from their experiences.
No, it's totally an honor to have you here today. Thank you so much. Thank you everyone that was participating in the chat and that was watching today or listening to the podcast version later. Everyone, thank you so much for being here. Mr. Vilmes, once again, thank you so much. Everyone, take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Okay. Yep, thank you. Bye.